From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, this is the PBP Voices of Baseball.
We bring you the people who bring you the game.
Yes, indeed. Welcome in to this episode of the PBP, where we celebrate, dissect, and explore Major League Baseball play-by-play. A great story for you with our guest in a matter of moments. But allow me a minute to recap 3 days of doing the Cubs and the Cardinals at Wrigley Field. I was emotionally and psychologically overwhelmed by the entire process of working at it and then getting to do it. And folks, it was absolutely thrilling. I've talked about it a bit on the day job at Parkins and Spiegel, and I'm writing about it as well, but I don't want to shortchange it for anyone who just hears this here on the PBP. The walking in, having the peaceful quiet of the empty park, and knowing that it's my job that day, it's my gig to get as close to it as anyone gets to the ballpark. All the jobs there in the ballpark, and the one that I had on those days was that close. Just an incredible feeling. And I found myself getting there earlier each and every one of the 3 days. Just wanted to get there earlier and soak it in as much as possible. The games themselves were incredible. The Cardinals and the Cubs in games of consequence, back and forth. There was a rain delay of about 90 minutes on Saturday in the middle of the game in the seventh inning. I even enjoyed that. I enjoyed all of it. Just the opportunity to be there. And next week, we're going to break it down with a very special guest. I'll tell you more about that at the end of the podcast. So I won't talk about all of it because I'll do some of that with our guest next week that I'm very thrilled to have back on the show. Somebody who's already done the show, who volunteered to come back on and just kind of discuss it because they wanted to. So that'll be cool. That'll be next week. But thank you for listening each and every week as you have. And for any of you that also checked out the ball games, thank you so much. It was nice to interact with a lot of people who know the podcast and appreciate the form the way that I do. Today, a story and a person I can relate to, and I bet you can too. Imagine this. After 30 years in the minor leagues, Johnny Dosko got the call that he'd written off. The call he had decided was never going to come. The Oakland A's asked him to join the Major League club as part of the MLB broadcasting team. He finally made it to the show. His story and the way he went about his life for the last 3 decades, frankly, is pretty darn inspiring. I loved this conversation, and I bet you will too. Here on the PBP this week, Oakland A's broadcaster Johnny Dosko.
Johnny Dosko, what an amazing, wonderful story. You know, people went crazy for Drew Maggi when he got to the Pirates because he had played 13 seasons in the minors and 1,155 games in the minors. That is chicken feed for Johnny Dosko. 4,000 games as a minor league broadcaster?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. You know what? I wasn't one of those guys that kept track. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to be honored for games or anything, but doing the math, it's over 4,000, somewhere 4,000 something. I don't know, but it's over 4,000 for sure. I know that.
So 30 years as a minor league broadcaster, starting with the Cedar Rapids Colonels in 93.
That's right.
And then what, 22 years in Sacramento with the Rivercats in Triple
A? That's right. Yep. 22 years in Sac.
All right. So here's the first thing. That's an amazing career. Those last 30 years, just regardless of what's happening now and what we're going to talk about, that's an amazing career from the outside, but also from the inside. You have to get proud of your career or else you can't put on your pants every day. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
So I assume and I hope that you were a happy and satisfied broadcaster for a lot of that, not just some guy like with a pipe dream over his shoulder the whole time. You know what I mean? How did it feel to you along the
way? I'm glad to hear you say that because absolutely. I was very proud of that. I was proud of the fact I had 30 years broadcasting baseball and getting paid to do it. So that meant, you know, look, that concept as it is crazy, right? Getting paid to call baseball, if you think about it. But it's so easy to get caught up, I think, and, you know, I got to get to the big leagues. Then I'm worthy, right? But it's not like that at all. That 30 years, I was satisfied. And I did this. It's true. I know it said in the article, it's factual. I was when I was in my 50s, when I got in my early 50s, I said to my wife, I said, look, this is probably not going to happen. And it's okay. I'm in AAA, and I've been in AAA a long time. People don't really usually get a chance in their 50s. I'm still love what I do. I have a connection with the game, and I'm connecting with the manager and the coaches and the players and the other broadcasters and the fans. So those connections, no matter what level, are enrich you, right? So I never was really I never was one of those guys that said I'm only worthy if I go to the show. Not at all. So those 30 years, I was very, very, and very, still very proud of that. That's in me, you know? And so I was very proud to be calling AAA baseball that long and to be in professional baseball that long. You know, sure. You get to A ball, it's still a gift. If you're broadcasting A ball, there are a lot of people that would kill to do that. So, you know, look, I knew it was a hard road when I started, and I'm just grateful for everything that I have, you know.
It reminds me, you know, as a talk show host, I've talked about these stories so many times, whether it's a college football coach who dreams of the NFL and never gets to do it or chooses not to do it. There are people who choose to just stay in a happy lane as well, you know. So it's like, It's easy to ascribe somebody's own goals and dreams to someone else. So, and,
right.
But you know, it's interesting. You built a whole life in AAA, and we're going to talk a lot about the broadcasting and everything. But dude, you wrote a book about baseball and life through the use of the haiku. You became an ordained minister and did the weddings of a bunch of players you became friendly with along the way. Derek Barton, Max Stassi, you did their weddings. Is that true?
I did. Yeah. You know, I started doing weddings back. My buddy, my best friend got married in 02, and I did a wedding. And then I don't know how it came up, but I think may have been Graham Godfrey was my first one. I don't know, but then it started getting around to baseball with some of the players that I did weddings. Yeah. And you know, you get ordained online, you know, so it was something I enjoyed doing. I'm 13, 1-1. So I have 13 are still married, one divorce and one separation, still holding out hope that one is, so I can go to 14-1. So pretty good record. But I love it. I love doing it. And you know, just you know, some I do better than others. I had a little humor into it, but it's, I keep it pretty serious, you know? So, So that's been pretty cool.
That's so cool. All right. So let's go back to the game. What did you learn about baseball through all the years of broadcasting that you couldn't have learned any other way in terms of watching a game and doing a game for 4,000 games, 30 years? What's some stuff you learned about the game that you couldn't have learned without doing it?
That's a good question. I think just kind of the game within the game, all the intricacies of the game, the things we don't think about, right? Like there's just so much, every game is like a snowflake, right? Because every game is different. And you don't really, there's so many things within the game that I had no clue about, you know, and just, I think just being around this game every single day, all the, just the moves the manager makes, and just in the minor leagues, just how they use pitchers, right? Like you know, pitchers are used so, so differently in the minor leagues because it's about rest and it's about, you know, how they feel about a certain guy. The minor leagues are so different than the big leagues, especially you get to A ball, right? Because you know, most of those guys, I mean, look, you get to A ball, 12% of those guys will ever get a taste of the big leagues, right? And how many of those will stay, right? 4 to 5%. So I think I learned in the minor leagues, it's all about development. And I know winning's part of that development, but I learned kind of the development part of it. And maybe they'll keep a guy in to test him in the minor leagues. And even if he gets roughed up, they're not worried about his numbers. Like I've seen guys stay in there and I'm like, why is he still in the game? He's allowed 9 runs. Well, they're testing him. They want to test him to see how he can handle all this. So I think the development part of it, I didn't really understand when I got in the game, when I got in the minor leagues, because in the big leagues, it's all about winning, right? That's the bottom line. The minor leagues, it's not, it is about winning, but it isn't. You're about developing guys. That's why you see guys go down rehab and they allow 11 runs in 2 2/3. They say that was a good outing. You know, I felt good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's part of it.
What's the biggest challenge to being a AAA broadcaster in terms of actually doing the job, showing up and doing the job?
Well, I think one of the challenges is, and it was especially true before they gave every Monday off, was the travel. Because, you know, remember after the All-Star break back in the minor leagues, we had in AAA, we had 54 games in 55 days. So it's a lot. There's a lot of, you know, late nights. I remember a game, man. So I'll admit this. I don't even know if I've ever admitted this publicly before, but there was we had a game in Albuquerque that went late. It was a late game. Come from behind, Albuquerque came back to beat the Rivercats. This, I think, was in 2011 or so. And then we flew from Albuquerque to Round Rock, and so with no sleep because it was an early morning to Round Rock. And there was a time in the game, it was like the fifth or sixth inning when I did the game at Round Rock, that I literally, Jeff Larish was at the plate. I literally dozed off for three or four. So I was so tired that I dozed for 3 or 4 seconds. And then when I woke, you know, when you wake up and you're super alert, I woke up and right when Larish was making contact, so I go, fly ball deep right. I had just woken up from a 4 second nap, you know, and it was jarring. It was alarming, but that's how tired I was. But that's the minor leagues, right?
How was the call?
I think it was a pretty good call. I don't know if I can do it right now. It was a pretty good call. I was super alert, super awake, over-enthusiastic, right? But it was, yeah, I fell asleep on the air. I did.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm thinking about all the times I woke up in the middle of sleep and just blurted something out from a dream that I was having.
Exactly.
The opportunity there. Oh, that's amazing. Did you have to be your own engineer along the way?
Yes.
Times people think you're a one-man production crew, right?
It's amazing. Yeah, you pretty much run it all. You're doing all your engineering. There's a board op back at the studio, but you're doing all your own engineering, which you bring your own gear and everything. That's what has been so cool about the big leagues is that you have an on-site engineer. You got an engineer back at the studio. I'm like, I'm not bringing my gear. I'm just bringing my computer, my stuff. Yeah. It's amazing. I'm like, wait, so you guys do all this? They're like, yep. I'm so appreciative. They're like, what are you talking about? Of course we do. And I'm just I'm just appreciative of everything right now. You know, just
tell me, man, tell me, like, so this is your Nuke LaLoosh making it to the show, you know, your Crash Davis moment where all the women have, you know, blonde hair and brains and you can't have fungus on your shower shoes, yada, yada. But like, what are you feeling as like, what are the perks so far as a big league broadcast?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, like last night, just the charter flights are incredible. You know, I'm used to Southwest in AAA, you know, where you're just kind of, you know, you do that thing. I had it mastered too in Southwest flights. We would I'd have someone I know on the aisle or on the window. I'd be in the aisle. And you act like you're giving directions so no one would sit in the middle. You know, you do this thing with your hands. And that worked a lot. I was like 98%. I was great at it. So I just don't like, you know, being crazy. But anyway, the big leagues, it's all first-class seats. They come up, what would you like, Johnny? What would you like to, you know, what would you like to eat? It's a whole other world. So that's been pretty cool. And the hotels have been great. I mean, I'm at the Four Seasons right now in Houston. It's incredible, you know. And look, hotels in AAA weren't bad. There were some Marriotts and Holiday Inn Selects, and there's some decent hotels, but this is another world, you know. So that's been pretty cool, that part. And the stadiums, right? The stadiums are incredible. They're palaces, you know. So that part of it, too, is I'm kind of wide-eyed when I walk into these stadiums. I hope I always am. I hope I never take it for granted, you know.
That's beautiful. It's the 56-year-old rookie, Johnny Dosko, with us here. So, I mean, and look, Johnny, I'm 52. And so I relate. You're an inspiration for me. You're an inspiration for a lot of people. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there. There are a lot of us out there, people in our 50s who refuse to give up, don't want to give up. And, you know, dream of something, and maybe we'll get that chance. And I'm wondering, like, where did that come from? Something in you or in your life, in your family? And I reference it for this, like my mother always wanted to be a doctor, couldn't afford to go to medical school when she was a kid. In her 50s, she decided to be an emergency medical technician and work on an ambulance, like one day a week and one weekend a month. It's like, yeah. She wanted to still do it. And I love that. And I feel like, dude, that is spiritually in me and why I'm still chasing this ridiculous dream of being a play-by-play guy, even though I'm 52. So where did you get this gumption to kind of keep going and keep yourself open to the opportunity that actually has now come your way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, Look, I knew as a little boy that I wanted to do this at the big league level. I knew when I was super young, when I'd go around interviewing family members with a pencil when I was 6 years old, and them turning down the TV and broadcasting the game into the TV set, growing up listening to Vin Scully in Los Angeles, listening to Chick Hearn, listening to Bob Miller, listening to all the greats in LA. And I just always knew I wanted to do it. Now, when I started to realize how tough it was when I started the career, and I realized, like, when I was in A-ball, I said, I'm going to make it pretty quickly. It's going to be 3 or 4 years. I'm going to get to AAA for 1 year and go to the big leagues. I'm special, you know? And it didn't quite work out that way. But I think it's been in me since I've been a little boy, and I just didn't ever want to give up the dream. You know, I said, I'm not going to give this up. I'll die in the chair. I'm not going to give it up, you know? So I just always knew I was determined to do it. Now, look, I'm realistic to think that there are guys in our league, in the PCL, that were as good, if not better than me. So it's like, not everybody's going to make it, right? When you're in AAA, not everybody's going to make it. But I did believe in my heart that I was going to, until I got into my 50s. In my 50s, that's when I kind of said, you know what? Check yourself. It's probably not going to happen. And my wife believed in me. My wife was like, you still could do it. I go, babe, it's not going to happen. It's okay. You can tell me it's not going to happen. It's okay. I'm fine with it. So you see people, you know, and you're excited for people that get there. You're jealous. You know, you have that jealous, you know, that thing inside you where it's like,
of course,
when you don't know them, you're like, you're really jealous. When you know the person, you're jealous for a bit, but you're happy for your friend. Right. But everybody gets called up around you. Right. So you have all the players, you're excited for the players, and you're like, when is my chance, like as Sushant said, when is my chance going to happen, you know? So it's it's always been in me. I've always believed, but there was a time where I was like, this AAA is not too bad. Check yourself and realize that you're lucky to be calling AAA baseball. How many people would kill to call AAA baseball, right? Yeah. You know, so that's kind of where I was with it, you know. I kind of had peace with it. And then when things started, as he said in the article, as the rejection letter started to get a little more personal. And I do think the deviated septum surgery helped me, because I was very nasally for a long time. And then when I had that surgery, my voice was a little bit better. I still don't have a great voice, but it was better. It was a better voice than I had. Yeah. And I know I knew the game. So I always felt I had a shot, but a couple of years ago, I was like, probably not going to happen. You know?
So you had the deviated septum surgery. It strikes me now that that's performance enhancing surgery. So that's like your Tommy John. You should have just gone ahead and had it in high school, like some of these kids do. Right?
That's a good one. That's true. Right? Am I Tommy John? Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, who knew? I mean, if you knew it was going to change it like that.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Seeing the players come up, get promoted around you, it's got to be crazy. I know you got friendly with several players, right? Who were some of the guys you got friendly with who went on to have big league careers and maybe you're still in contact with?
Yeah, I'm in touch with a bunch of guys, and you know, look, I'm in touch with most of the players I'm in touch with never got to the big leagues. You know, most of the players I'm in touch with I knew in A ball and knew in AAA, and a lot of them, some of them never made it. So I'm still, they're just their friend. I you connect with people you connect with, right? It doesn't discriminate as far as if they go to the big leagues or not. But right. You know, look, Eric Hillius is a friend of mine. Frank Langford's a friend of mine. That's from back in the day. There's so many guys. I mean, it's just you, when you're in the game as long as I've been, you make friendships, right? And coaches too. I mean, I know all my, like Darren Bush, who was the manager in 2011. He's the bench coach now here in Oakland. So I know him. I know Scott Emerson. I know Todd Steverson. A lot of our coaches. Steve Scarsoni. All those guys. So I've been really fortunate. Chris Spire was a guy that was the 1997 High Desert manager, and so I got close with him. So there are a lot of players throughout the years, coaches that you just connect with, right? So yeah. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, what is so great about it and about the life, and I assume it was, you know, that way for you, is like going down and hanging around, talking to the players and talking to the coaches. Is there more access in AAA?
It's different access, you know. I'm finding it's different, you know. In AAA, you're kind of a rock band, in that everybody's together, everybody's the same. You know what I mean? It's in the big leagues, it's a little more separated. You have a certain time you go in the clubhouse, a certain, you know, there's a little more separation in the big leagues than there is in AAA and A ball, you know, where you're kind of all mixed in together, and you're on the buses together, and you're the long commercial flights. So it's different. There are the big leagues are better. Let's be honest. It's better. It's better in the big leagues than it is in the minor leagues, but there are certain aspects of AAA that are pretty cool.
Like what? Tell me.
Well, just the fact that I feel like you're in the clubhouse, you're kind of with the team a little bit more. It could be the fact that I was in Sacramento for so long that we changed affiliates in 15. So I got to get to know the players and coaches there a little bit, because I didn't know, they were amazed at Giants. But after you've been there a while, you get the trust of the players, you get the trust of the coaches, the trust of the manager. And once you get that trust, it's a good feeling, because, you know, they know they can trust you with stuff that you know, they never got to say it on the air. And so, yeah. There's a lot of, you know, it's different. Maybe at some point I'll get there in the big leagues, but AAA, there, I was in Sacramento so long that I was fortunate enough to get the trust of everybody.
You know, it's funny because, like, it's the secret of being comfortable at the ballpark, at least for me anyway, when I started going to ballparks and you're like, oh my God, I have a press pass. I can go into Wrigley. I can go into Guaranteed Rate. And right. Like, oh my God, I'm nervous as hell, right? To walk around. And then you start, oh, I know that security guard. I know that elevator guy.
Yeah,
and it's just like, those are the people, the people that are actually there, you see every day. I mean, you were the OG in Sacramento. These players would come, and that's your house.
Right? Well, I was there a long time, man. I was there a long time. So I was fortunate. I was fortunate to be there a while. There are definitely advantages to being in a place a long time with familiarity, for sure. There's no question.
So, all right. Yeah. Tell us about the roving hitting instructor. I mean, that speaks to your comfort level as an OG in Sacramento.
Oh, it was a blast. We would mess with players. A player would come up, and I think the best was D Brown. We messed with D Brown because and Lou Merlone and Jeremy Brown set this up. So they said, hey, let's do the roving hitting guy with D Brown. And so they were like, Jeremy Brown and Merlone were like rolling their eyes, like, oh, this Rover's in town. He's the worst. To D Brown, they're like, just deal with him. He's tough. He's really tough. But
this
you're
a young player. It's a young player who's just new to AAA, and the older players who are there are setting that young player up to talk to the roving hitter.
Yes, and normally it's a young player, but Dee Brown was actually more of a vet. That was the funny part. He was more like he had been there a while. So I met him and I said, "Yeah, I'm Bill McCormick. Nice to meet you. I've been working on your swing. I've been looking. You look like you're coming through quick. You're too quick." He goes, "You noticed that?" I'm like, "Yeah." So I'm like behind him doing tip. You know, I'm like, "You need your hands here. You need your hands here and not here." He's like, "Huh? Never heard that book." So it was great. So finally, after about 15 minutes, Merlone couldn't handle it anymore. He's like, "I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm sorry. That's our radio guy. That's our radio guy." So, but we did that a lot. We did that to a lot of players. It was fun. It was
for
fun.
15 minutes. This player thinks you are the organization's roving hitting instructor, yes. And you're just 100% with him.
Oh yeah, messing with the whole time. It was great. Oh, he was laughing, but he was I can't believe it. Oh, he was just like he was.
So, you know, hitters, man. He might have gotten his head. You might have had some good ideas. Like he might have thought you were onto something, right?
Exactly. It's fun, man. We've had a lot of fun through the years. I haven't done anything in the big leagues like that, but in the minor leagues, we had so much fun with that, just messing with guys, you know.
Oh, see, here's the thing. Like, you have a little anonymity as you go into a new ballpark. How many ballparks have you been in now at the big league level? As you know, working with the A's. I mean, for this year, you've
written. Let's see. I went to Texas. We went to. I didn't go on the Tampa Baltimore trip. So Texas and Kansas City and New York went to Yankee Stadium, which was really cool. Really cool. Yeah. See, that was
there you are as a broadcaster with your press pass on the field. You could have messed with Aaron Judge somehow.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if that would be the best move, but maybe a year or two in, we'll see. We'll see. But yeah,
we got to think of something, man. We need to think of something that you can do, somebody that you can pretend to be so you can get your shtick on, because that's right. It's important.
Get it going.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's amazing. So, so this was the first thing you ever wanted to be. You mentioned some of the guys. Who are the broadcasters that you grew up hearing and wanting to sound to be like?
You know, Chick Hearn was my guy, the Lakers announcer. He was my guy. Vin Scully too, but Chick Hearn especially, the basketball announcer for the Lakers. He was a guy I imitated growing up, and I loved his style. But Vin Scully, of course, was the standard. He's great. I always loved John Miller. Actually, Ken Korak, a guy I'm working with now, I always loved listening to his work. Like, he's been there 28 years. I mean, I wasn't a young child when I heard him, but I've always, you know, emulated him. He's just a incredible broadcaster, great pipes and everything. And I actually enjoyed Herb Carneal in Minnesota. There's a bunch of guys, man. It's funny because everybody's got a different style, right? So you just pick certain things from announcers that you really like, you know, and that's your deal. But you always have to have your own style. I'm fortunate to have my own style, and not everybody's gonna. You got to remember, not everybody's gonna love you. There are gonna be people who don't like you, you know, especially in first year. They're not gonna. Not everybody's gonna embrace you right away. So it just it takes time. So I'm just enjoying what I'm doing.
So trying to get it at some of that style. A great play-by-play person has to be a technician and do the craft, but also you got to be an entertainer, you know, and people come at this from different angles. Like, where did you start on that scale in terms of technician, entertainer, and where are you now?
It's funny. Yeah, that's funny because I think I'm more of a technician. I think I don't add a ton of humor. I think the Sacramento fans got to know my humor in kind of a subtle way, right? Because people say, "Oh, wow, you're funny in real life. Why don't you bring that to?" Because it's, you know, look, I'm here to call a game. I want to know the score. They want to know what's going on, and you can entertain a little bit here and there, but for me, it's more nuts and bolts. And I'll tell stories and everything, but people want to know what's going on in the game. And the best compliment my dad ever gave me, he wasn't big for compliments, but he told me, he said, he goes, "I always know what's going on in the game when you're calling it." That made me feel really good because that's what I want. I want to call the game. Yeah. There are guys and girls that entertain on the air for sure. But I think that comes in time with the audience, right? The audience has to know the authenticity. They have to know your authentic self, right? And that can't be forced. It has to come organically because fans will see right through it. You got to be yourself and admit when you make a mistake. And I made plenty of them. Admit it. And that, in Sacramento, I'd make mistakes and just laugh about it because the fans, they know you're human. They know you're not perfect, and they know who you are authentically, you know?
That, now, some of that is great wisdom for broadcasting of any kind. Like, be your authentic self, because people know when you're phony. And then it's easier to stay consistent when you're actually just being yourself.
No question, because we're all idiots. Let's be honest, you know?
I love that compliment from your dad so much. One of my favorite things to do when I get a chance is to, like, turn on a ball game, not knowing the score or the inning or the situation, and see how quickly I can get there.
Just
from the sound of the crowd, the tone of the voice, the excitement or lack thereof. Is the home team losing? Like, you can pick all that up if the tone you're setting is correct.
No question. You also, your question earlier about what I've learned and what surprised me, I think using silence is something that I didn't know about when I first started in this business. Using the crowd in the minor leagues, it's harder sometimes when you have no crowd noise, but it's harder now with the pitch timer, for sure. There's no question. It's more challenging now to use silence, but using silence, John Miller does it as good as anybody. He does. He understands the pacing, the silence. Really great announcers, I feel, embrace that silence with the crowd. And I'm telling you, there's a beauty to it. There's a beauty to silence when you're broadcasting baseball that I think it's more challenging now with the pitch timer, but it's important.
No, I think you're right. Because it's a different sport than all the others. It's a companion. And you're just kind of hanging around with it as part of your life. And nobody wants to feel an oppressive broadcaster who's just in their face the whole time.
Right. Exactly.
Is there a specific item that you have to have with you in the booth, whether it's a good luck charm or a talisman or a kind of pen to keep score with? What is a specific thing you always have with you for every game?
Well, one thing I always have with me is this is going to sound weird, but it's not even a superstitious thing. It's a weird thing. I always have to have a big thing of water with me at all times. And that's with me in life too. I have to have water with me when I go, wherever I go, I have to have water. It's just a weird, weird thing. I don't like to go without the water, but I've been carrying around this thing that Steve Sachs gave me. Steve Sachs, this is kind of sad, you know. Steve Sachs's kid passed away. And he gave me this medallion of his son. And I've been carrying that around with me in my pocket. And when I had that in my pocket is when I got all this big league stuff started to come at me. It's crazy. So I don't know. I've had that with me for every game that I've called since. Wow. But besides that, just honestly, like, I'm trying to think of other things I've had. Not really. I don't really have anything. Honestly, I don't really have anything with me at every game. You know, some guys, like, I know Russ Langer in Vegas has the sand thing, you know, so he says the score before the sand runs out every time. So it's cool, you know. But
I have one of those. My agent gave me one of those before I got to do my first inning. He's like, you know, just to use that, one of those little egg timers. I love the medallion though. That's beautiful. That's emotional.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, it is emotional. And, you know, like his son tragically passed last summer in a routine mission. He's a Marine, it was just a practice mission, and he passed. And I really enjoyed working with Steve Sachs. He's a wonderful guy, and we really enjoyed my time with him. And so it was really tragic. And so I always carry around that medallion of John Sachs, his son. And so I will never not have that with me.
That's beautiful. I wanted to ask you about a couple of calls. Is there, would you tell us about the Drew Robinson?
Yes, absolutely.
And that call, because what an incredible story that a lot of baseball fans eventually got hip to when he made his way back. But the whole story is incredible, and you got a chance to call a big moment.
Yeah, thank you. He is an amazing guy. And, you know, for those that don't know the story, you know, Drew attempted suicide. He lost his right eye in the suicide attempt. He survived it, obviously. And then he said, you know what, I'm going to make a comeback. I'm trying to play baseball. And I said, look, I think it's great. He's trying to play baseball. There's no way he's ever going to make contact. It's impossible. If you're a left-hand hitter and you don't have a right eye, how in the world do you see? I mean, it's just impossible to me. I don't know how you would do that. But not only did he's just such a great athlete too. And just the fact that he was on the field got me emotional, right? Every time he was, even every time I just, when I met him, I really connected with him. We had just a great simpatico. We really connected well. And then he started the season with the team, and I'm like, he's not going to make contact, let alone he's not, he may find a way to ground out to second base, but he's not going to, I mean, no matter how good an athlete he is, you're talking about guys with 95 with movement. Like, you're not, how are you going to see the ball, let alone, you know, you have one eye. Like, so anyway, so he started off and he got a hit, which was incredible. And then
as Milburn from the far first base side of the rubber looks in, another 1-0 pitch. That swung on, a drive to deep right field. Going back is Pinder, and it's gone! Oh, Drew Robinson, a solo shot, and it's 4-1. So Drew Robinson unloads a solo homer here in the second inning. Well, that feels good. All smiles as he points to his friends and family.
It was just so emotional, just watching that moment, watching him hit a home run in Vegas, his hometown, going around the bases, waving to his family, and just how far he had come from a suicide attempt to playing in a professional baseball game to hitting a home run. It just, it overcame me. It was just too much. It was amazing. So I got off the air and I was sobbing. Like, it was really hit me hard. I love this guy. So that was the best moment of my career for sure. It really was.
That's beautiful. It's an incredible call. And baseball offers those moments every once in a while, and it feels like you can feel the tension and the excitement and the hope. And when something like that happens, I'm thinking there's so many different things through the years, right? I'm thinking about D. Gordon's home run after Jose Fernandez died. You remember that?
Yes. Oh my God. So emotional.
Right. I love that you had that moment. It probably represented a lot more than just Drew Robinson's story. There's your life and everything that you're bringing to the table.
It did, man. This game is so rich in that way, right? Like, there's just so much to it. And you look, this game is passed along generation to generation, from not only dads to sons and daughters, but moms to sons and daughters. That, you know, like, I was reading a story the other day about a kid who, a player who came up, and he said, look, my dad didn't really like the game that much. My mom gave me my first glove. My mom raised me with this game. And so Mother's Day was special for him. And so baseball lends itself to going with your family, and the pace of it, just talking, and they got the game, and it's pretty cool. I know I'm kind of rambling on it, but it is a really cool game. I was raised with baseball. You walk into our house and there's the first thing you see at my dad's house is mom and dad's house is just a group bookcase full of baseball books, right? So I was raised with the game. He grew up going to Yankees games as a kid on the subway by himself at 7 years old. Like, that's when it was a lot safer, obviously, but 7 years old, he'd go to the subway by himself, keep score, come back. So he was into the game. So he kind of gave that to us, right? That was his gift to us, is teaching us the game of baseball. So it's, we all keep score. We're one of those families, all five of us kept score at games growing up, you know? So it's, I don't have the backwards K, I have the K. And then if it's a swinging strikeout, I circle it. I don't do the K and backwards K for the strikeout. Yeah, I do it differently.
What a wonderful thing. It's our own language. Here I'm saying our. I've done 11 innings over 11 games, Johnny. I'm sorry. But like, yeah, it's its own language. What else do you do? Do you pitch count when you score a card? When you keep scoring? Some guys count pitches as they're going.
I don't really need to anymore, you know, because everything's up there. Everything's, you know what I mean? It's like everything is out there and up there. But yeah, Vince Catronio is really good at that. My fellow broadcaster here with the A's, he did that before it was in to do that, the way he counts pitches. John Miller does too. Yeah. It's important.
What's the difference between a crowd of a few thousand at a packed AAA game and a crowd of a few thousand at the Oakland Coliseum?
You want a packed house. You know, you want it to be a big crowd, and the crowds are what they are right now. So it just got to deal with that. And it's you want bigger crowds, obviously, for the crowd noise and everything like that. And it's something else when you're at a stadium. I remember doing a game in 12 at the Texas State. It was just 52,000 people, and it's just loud, and it's exciting. You know, it's exciting. Yeah,
you did how many games did you do in 2012? That was the first real call up, because you got that in spring training too.
Yeah, I did 34 games. Yeah, because Korak had a knee replacement surgery. So I got to do 34 games. I'll never forget. I was in the office with the director of broadcasting at the time, and he goes, it's Ken Priest, and he goes, yeah, we're going to have you do, we're going to need you for some games. You know, I'm like, okay, it was in spring training. It came out of the blue. He goes, we'll have you do Texas series, Seattle series. And by the way, you're going to do Baltimore, Tampa, and Boston. As soon as he said Boston, Fenway, I was started bawling. as soon as he said Fenway, tears were just streaming down my face. I was like, oh my gosh, incredible, right? Chance to do games at Fenway. Yeah. That was pretty cool. That was pretty cool, you know. And Fenway, it's funny, Mickey Morabito, the legend, he'll be in the Hall of Fame someday, traveling secretary here. I remember we were at the hotel in Boston, we were coming out, and I was going to get on the bus, and I'm like, you know what? I'm walking. He's like, you're walking. It's like 45 minutes. I'm like, I don't care, Mick. I want to soak it all in. I want to walk to the ballpark from the hotel. I don't care how long it is. I want to just embrace this walk. I went very early to the game, you know, and it was pretty cool. Pretty cool.
That's amazing. There's nothing like a neighborhood ballpark like that too. You're walking through the city and then turn the corner. Then, oh yeah, there's the ballpark right there.
Exactly. So special. Yeah. So cool.
That's so cool. Do you, you miss your Sacramento family?
Yeah, absolutely. Family? Yeah. I still talk to a lot of the folks over there. I'll always talk to them, but yeah, I definitely miss them, and they were so good to me and for so long. And so, yeah, no, I had a great run there, you know, and it was perfect timing for me. Just, you know, Zach Baderudy's in there now, and he's doing a great job with doing the play-by-play there, and good for him, because he had left Reno. So for him to, he was not working in baseball. He just thought, hey, I'll just do basketball now. So he got that gig. So that's cool. So that, yeah. He's crushing it over there. So that's good.
That's
so
awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to close with asking about some of the best advice you ever got. So I'm thinking, and it could be, how about mechanically for doing the job? Let's start there. So to actually, in terms of actually doing the job, preparing for each game and do it, like any advice that you might have or that you got that's been helpful to you to actually do the job.
Well, one would be that what we talked about earlier, be your authentic self. Always be yourself. Don't try to be anybody else, right? Always be yourself. That's key. The other thing is watch the ball. Describe what's going on. Watch the ball. See what's going on. Don't anticipate. I think that's the one mistake I think I know I made. Like I would call a double play before it happened, and then the ball dropped. Then where are you, right? You wait until it's completed, and you know, you can use the crowd. You know, you still have time. Once a home run's hit, make sure it's a home run. I'll never forget in 1993, I think it was my first game. I thought it was maybe game two or three. There was a fly ball to left field that I called playable, because the left fielder was just standing like this, but he was standing there sarcastically. I didn't know. And it went like 40 feet over the fence. I go, fly ball to left, playable. Wait a minute, that ball's gone. You know, it's embarrassing, right? Like it was a humiliating call. And I've had some really bad ones, and that was one of the worst. That was early on. So I would say, wait a little, you know, wait a little bit. But, you know, what's the third baseman doing, right? How far is he off the line? You know, what's going on? Everything in the ballpark. What's going on over here? You just describe, be descriptive, and have fun. Be authentic, and let us know what's going on in the game. Right? Let us know what's going on. They're pretty basic, right? Yeah. Let us know what's going on in the game, and then the entertainment from there will come in time, right?
Yeah, that makes all the sense in the world. And then any advice you got about your career overall, or just kind of.
I would just keep doing games, right? Just keep doing games. Like even if you're doing independent league ball and it's 110 games, who cares? You're doing games, right? Just keep doing games. You need reps. You need reps. It's not, you know, right? Like, it's like a player coming up. Oh, you need 500 bats at AAA. You know, you I think you have to have 500 to 1,000 games at least to not master your craft, because you never really master it, but I'd say to kind of get comfortable with your craft and get comfortable with knowing who you are as an announcer, right? You need games. You can't just all of a sudden 100 games into the minor leagues and all of a sudden you go do the big leagues. You're just not ready. You know what I mean? So, and that's, I'm so fortunate that I was able to do a ton of minor league ball before I got to the big leagues. Now I'm still learning TV. Like I'm doing some TV now, and I've done mostly radio. So I'm still learning that craft. So I'm learning all the time. So it takes time. It takes time, but be patient with yourself. I wasn't really patient with myself at times growing up. And I was like, there weren't times where I really thought I'm going to give this up, but I think you have to stick with it. And look, getting paid to call ball, do that as long as you can, you know, as long as you can do it. If you have a supportive partner, it helps a lot that they're saying, you know, like, you know, look, my wife, I'm very fortunate, you know, she's very patient with me in my career. So I got lucky in that regard too, for sure.
Johnny, what a pleasure, man. Happy for you. And we'll be tuning in and many, many more years in the bigs to you, sir.
I enjoyed it, man. I enjoyed it so much. Thanks so much for thinking of me and doing this. I really do. Thank you.
You got it. Yeah.
So Johnny says 500 to 1,000 games before you're ready. I've done 3. Okay. All right. Well, look, first of all, in terms of Johnny, the roving hitting instructor, that is an absolute all-timer. What a phenomenal way to use that unique combination of seniority, humor, and anonymity. That kind of ball busting is a love language at the ballpark, so I'm sure he's fitting right in Oakland. I find Johnny Dosko's story to be beautiful, maybe most of all because he gave up on the dream. He got to that spot where he gave up on it. And that's when it came true. There's something beautifully poignant about that. As for me, having just gotten a taste of it, here's the balance I decided I have to strike after doing 3 games. I definitely would love to do it again. I definitely would love to do it long term, somehow, some way. But who knows if I ever will? Who knows? There's a lot of factors that go into the availability, the possibility of a job like that. It's just insane. So I have to also think of it the way that Jack Nicholson did as Melvin Udall, that if that weekend, what I just did, what if this is as good as it gets? If that's as good as it gets, that's pretty darn good. And I will take it. Next week, Jason Benetti, the White Sox broadcaster, the national broadcaster for Fox, maybe my favorite person to talk about this stuff with so far, will come back and discuss the job now that I've done it. Really looking forward to talking about it with Jason. Might just let him do the interview. My producer on the PBP is the one and only Ryan Porth. Great job as always, Ryan. My collaborator is James Vickery. The theme music on the PBP comes from the great Kurt Morrison of Tributosaurus. Please find the podcast and tell a few thousand friends. Find the PBP, Voices of Baseball, on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. From 2400 Sports, Odyssey, and Major League Baseball, the PBP, Voices of Baseball. I'll bring you the people who bring you the game.